Hallo jazzvrienden en vriendinnen, welkom bij deel 4 van de Jazz is een podcast. Trouwens, heb je suggesties of vragen of eigenlijk wat je maar kwijt wil, je kunt het allemaal mailen naar info@jazzism.nl. Dus info@jazzism.nl, zeg er even bij dat het gaat over Koos podcast. Het jaar 2000, de bar van het Bel Air Hotel in Den Haag. Ik zit met een cameraman en een geluidsman klaar om Tony Bennett te interviewen. Daar was ik natuurlijk behoorlijk gespannen over, want ja, Tony Bennett, een levende legende. En ik wist helemaal niet hoe dat gesprek zou lopen. Maar we hadden al heel snel een klik. Het was echt een ongelooflijke leuke ervaring. Wat een bijzondere man, wat een aardige man. En wat een verrassing dat tijdens het gesprek opeens Toon Hermans ter sprake kwam. Ik wist dat zowel Tony als Toon ook schilderden. Ze kenden elkaar als kunstschilder. Nou, hij wist dat Toon was overleden en wilde graag in contact komen met de familie, of ik een idee had. Nou ken ik toevallig de kleinzoon van Toon Hermans goed, mijn goede vriend Rafael Hermans. Zelf een zeer succesvol beeldend kunstenaar en een uitstekende muzikant. Ik dacht dat is misschien een link, dat is misschien een mogelijkheid om ze met elkaar in contact te brengen. Een paar uur later kwam ik Rafael tegen in het congrescentrum in Den Haag, waar toen het Noordzee plaatsvond. En hij was op zoek naar Tony Bennett. En ja, we hebben elkaar gesproken, met z'n drieën, in de coulissen. En ik wist niet precies of het nou voor of na het optreden was, of hoe het nou precies zat. Ik dacht, weet je wat, ik ga gewoon naar Rafael Hermans toe. Op de koffie bij Rafael Hermans, om terug te blikken naar 2000. Tony Bennett, Toon Hermans, The Jazz is a Podcast, deel 4. Ja, Rafael, ik heb je dus even opgezocht, want ja, het was 2000, een tijdje geleden. Veel gebeurt in die tussentijd, bij jou ook. Maar ik weet nog wel dat toen ik dat Tony Bennett interview had opgenomen, hij opeens begon te vragen of ik wist wie Toon Hermans was. Nou ja, goed, dat weet natuurlijk elke Nederlander. Dus ik zeg, ja, hoezo? Nou ja, ik wil in contact komen met de familie om allerlei redenen. En kun je mij in contact brengen? Ik zeg, nou, ik ken de kleinzoon van Toon Hermans. Ik heb hem zelf niet gekend, maar de kleinzoon, dat is een goede vriend van mij. Dus als ik die binnenkort spreek, dan zal ik zeggen dat contact weer opgenomen moet worden, et cetera, et cetera. En een paar uur later kwam ik volgens mij jou gewoon tegen.
Ja, ik ga gelijk al. Ik heb dus een andere versie in mijn hoofd. Dus ik ga je een soort van tegenspreken. Tenminste, dat hebben. Ik denk dat het zo was dat Tony in de krant gelezen heeft dat Toon was overleden.
Ja.
Dat heb ik begrepen toen. En omdat het allemaal zo snel ging en dat het lang, zeg maar, stil was. Dus pas op de dag van de begrafenis weet ik dat naar buiten is gekomen dat Toon overleden was, in de pers. En in die tijd, nee, hij was voor concerten in Nederland. En dat was allemaal heel rap gegaan bij de familie en er was geen tijd geweest om hem in te lichten. Dus dat was voor hem een soort shock om in de krant te lezen dat Toon overleden was. En het verhaal is dat hij, als hij in Nederland was, wat niet heel vaak voorkwam, maar toch wel zo om de 2-3 jaar, dacht ik een beetje, kwam hij altijd even, nam hij contact op met Toon. Hij is, geloof ik, 2 of 3 keer thuis geweest. Kwam hij met de grote limousine het terrein oprijden. Was natuurlijk ontzettend indrukwekkend. En nu las hij in de krant dat hij overleden was. En toen hebben wij, ik had toen besloten om hem, vanuit de familie is er een, Toon was, had een familieheilige vanuit zijn katholieke achtergrond. Dat was heilig Gemma Galgani uit Lucca. En daar is een klooster van de Sitter. Daar is Toon ook begraven. Daar ligt mijn oma ook begraven. En dat gebedsprentje kreeg iedereen die bij de begrafenis was. Ik vond dat een mooi idee om dat aan Tony te overhandigen. Toen hebben wij, ik had al een kaartje voor het concert van Tony, waar jij op het Noordzee aan het werk was. En toen hebben wij, meen ik, op de dag zelf of daarvoor een keer contact gehad van of jij hebt me, ik zie het, het wordt alweer heel verwarrend eigenlijk. Ja. Eigenlijk lever ik helemaal geen informatie aan nu. Ik heb toen het idee gehad dat ik jou heb gecontact. Toen zei jij, kom dan na de voorstelling even naar me toe. Maar wij kwamen elkaar tegen in de gang eerder. Dat is ook wat jij zei volgens mij.
Ja.
En toen zei hij tegen mij, jij liep de deur uit en ik liep op jou af. En toen zei jij, ik heb net met Tony Bennett over jouw werk gehad nog. En toen moest het concert nog komen en daarna hebben wij elkaar gezien.
Precies.
Zo, dat toch? Ja,
ja
dan zitten we een beetje op. Ja, oké. En toen heb jij mij, toen ben ik naar je toe gelopen en toen stond er geloof ik een rij van 20 man voor Tony Bennett te wachten. En toen zei meneer Codekloet aan de overkant hier, Raaf, kom, we lopen even naar hem toe. En toen mochten wij voor die 20 man. En toen heb jij mij even voorgesteld.
Ja, want ik had zo'n pasje.
Ja, ja, nee, ja. Dat was dus ook geweld. Maar ja. ik was al onder de indruk. Ik had hem al een keer ontmoet, ook volgens mij bij Toon in Hilversum. Maar ik was nog een stuk jonger toen, dus dat is me niet zo bijgebleven. En toen stond die uitermate vriendelijke, glinsterende man stond daar. Maar ik was onder de indruk. Ik heb hem dat gebedsprentje gegeven toen. En even kort gezegd, maar ik kreeg niet eens de kans om ook te zeggen hoe goed zijn concert was. Ik vond het helemaal geweldig. Dat was met het Ralph Sharon trio, volgens mij, dacht ik. En ik begon daar, ik wilde dat gaan zeggen, maar hij zei, nee, maar wacht even, wat maak jij prachtig werken. Dus Toon had mijn werk laten zien in het atelier. Ja. Dus ik was helemaal onder de indruk van dat hij over mij begon. Ik denk, nee, maar ik kom hier alleen maar om jou dat gebedspreetje te geven. Dat is, ja. Nou ja, dan zitten we, komen we een beetje bij elkaar in de buurt. Ja.
Want, nog even voor de zekerheid, ik heb het in mijn inleiding ook gezegd, datgene wat Toon en Tony bond, was het feit dat ze allebei schilderden.
Ja, 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 zeker ook. En natuurlijk ook een beetje het artiest zijn, maar dan Toon natuurlijk op zijn, op zijn niveau en genre. Ik weet ook eigenlijk niet meer hoe zij elkaar ontmoet hebben. Dat had ik eigenlijk, dat zou ik wel eens willen weten. Dat zou ik aan mijn vader moeten vragen. Er is natuurlijk ergens een ontmoeting geweest. Hij was zwaar fan van de Crooners al. En Toon heeft Frank Sinatra ontmoet. Sammy Davis, heb ik daar een foto van liggen trouwens. En dus dat moet op een of andere manier samen zijn gekomen. Maar die hadden een enorme klik. Dus als ze bij elkaar kwamen, ging het ook eigenlijk niet over de muziek of over wat hij in de shows deed, maar over het schilderen. Maar echt heel primair over wat gebruik jij dan en wat voor olie verf je, want ik doe dat zo en zet jij dan je doek zo en zo op. Ontzettend leuk natuurlijk. Ja. Heerlijk om allebei ook even uit de onzin te stappen van de gekte. Ja, dat is het. Echt wel een vriendschap, maar natuurlijk heel korte tijd en een uurtje voorbij. Of een keer in een hotel. Ik geloof dat ze wel eens in Den Haag in dat hotel zaten, waar vroeger het Noord-Zee was.
Ja. Bel Air Hotel.
Bel Air, denk ik, ja. En dat was het dan. En dan ze belden elkaar af en toe. Ja, heel leuk.
Maar de cirkel was rond toen jij die dag in 2000 het bidprintje gaf.
Ja, ik voelde mij echt geroepen om. En dat was natuurlijk voor mijn ooms en mijn vader ook natuurlijk een hectische tijd en ingewikkeld. Dus ze hebben dat waarschijnlijk helemaal niet goed bedacht om dan hem eventjes in te lichten. En ik dacht, nou, ik ga dat oppakken. Ik vond het leuk.
Dat is heel goed gelukt.
Ja.
En dat interview eerder die dag, dat klonk zo.
We are now in the bar of the Bel Air Hotel, where everything is quiet, and we get a chance to talk to Mr. Tony Bennett, one of the great vocalists at this 25th edition of the North Sea. Mr. Bennett, as a carrier of a great tradition, the great tradition of the crooners, I would like to have to take the opportunity to ask you, is it possible to define the term crooner?
Yeah, it's the art of intimate singing. It was invented by two people, Gene Austin, who made a record called My Blue Heaven and made everybody run to a record shop. He was the first guy who made everybody who said, I want to buy that record. I want to buy a phonograph player. He was the first one. He was forgotten, but he shouldn't have been, because he really was the first one that made a very big sensation. He made everybody open up record shops. That he was the inventor of it, really, the reason for it. He and Enrico Caruso, RCA Victor. But then Bing Crosby was the first singer who created the art of intimate singing using a microphone. You know, before that, all the entertainers and opera singers, you know, sang without a microphone. And he was the first one to actually get a microphone and kind of whisper intimately into the microphone. And he hypnotized the whole world. Even in Germany, during the war, they called him Der Bingo. And he was just international. He won 2 Academy Awards and really deserved each one. Big, like one movie called Country Girl, the other one Going My Way. And he taught us all how to make a living. Bing Crosby really showed us how to do it.
But still, in the world, there's a lot of singers, there's a lot of microphones, mm-hmm. but not as many crooners as the adding up of those two figures. So there must be something extra to it.
Well, it was a different era. That was an era where everybody was infatuated with radio, and radio was very, very big, you know. I think since the advent of television, it's not how you sound a lot, but how you look also. So a lot of pretty people just become very big with terrible voices.
Yeah.
But they look beautiful. So we forgive them.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was Louis Armstrong, who kept, you know, was Bing Crosby's favorite inspiration. He practically invented jazz, and Bing loved him. They did duets together and made movies together. And Louis was always a hit. A lot of people don't realize that he was really a great actor, but, you know, people tend to categorize people, and they figure, well, he's a jazz musician. But he saved almost every movie he was ever in, including Barbara Streisand's Hello, Dolly.
Yeah.
The picture wasn't working until he hit the screen and sang Hello, Dolly, and then the whole picture was lifted up.
Yeah.
And he was that way with every film, even the Crosby movies. People, oh, there's Louis Armstrong. You know, he did a little cameo, but it really worked.
Yeah.
And he's a big, big influence on all the crooners. If you didn't phrase his way, even Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, and Nat King Cole, they all kind of imitated Louis. He's the master.
In a period where labeling, useless as it may be in art, but popular as it is, with that labeling going on, could you say that the art form that you practice is some sort of a bridge between what people call the entertainment world and the jazz world?
I see all of the performers as entertainers. I mean, you know, Nat Cole, the ones I've seen, like Fred Astaire, who introduced the best songs, you know, he was an entertainer. Duke Ellington was an entertainer. Count Basie was an entertainer. Frank Sinatra, you know, hypnotized everybody when they saw him in person. They they loved him. Nat King Cole was beautiful on stage. So each one, Billie Holiday, they all loved performing. They loved entertaining people. They didn't do it just for themselves. Of course, they enjoyed their life because they liked doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
But they all wanted to, you know, knock people out of their seats. They all wanted to, you know, just really entertain people, make them feel great.
Well, one of the reasons I ask is that, for instance, in Holland,
yes,
there's a lot of conservatories where you have so-called light music departments. And you see that there's a great emphasis on technique, craftsmanship, virtuosity, playing hard bop, bebop. But there's actually no training in how to present yourself on a stage, for instance. Do you think that the entertainment bit is sometimes too much ignored?
Well, funny enough that you mention that, it takes about 10 years to learn how to start becoming a consummate performer. And the world today has changed so much that the record companies and all the producers, you know, they just want obsolescent music. They don't want anything to last, so they'll make someone as big and promise them you'll be as big as the Beatles or you know, or Michael Jackson or Paul McCartney, you know, but then they take 75% from the young artists. They make them go up and then crash them right down to the ground. And they go to the next one. It's quite cruel. I don't like what they do with the young people. Certain ones make it, like Madonna and Sting and, you know, the Billy Joel. Certain people have standard acts. But the majority really don't have a long life. But funny that you mentioned that question. It's interesting because I'm starting a school that the Board of Education in the United States has agreed to finance, and it's called the Frank Sinatra School of the Arts. And we're going to have the young people not only study from books, like you mentioned, but also go into the field and go to sing for blind people and go to charity concerts and schools and church basements and just get involved with performing, getting used to performing in front of people, getting them so that they're not shocked when they go out of school and say, my God, I have to walk on the stage. And instead of feeling frightened, they'll be used to performing before they graduate to high school. So that's the ambition of the school. And we have Harry Belafonte and Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, beautiful actors and actresses, the husband and wife actors and actresses. actors, and they're going to advise the students as to what to do. We're going to teach them the form and the technique, but they're also going to show them that they should really perform, because that's the only way they're going to survive in the long run. You know, even someone like Miles Davis, who kind of played for himself, but he was really performing. You know, he always performed. I mean, you know, you had to be different if you perform, and he was smart enough to turn his back to the audience. Everybody else is out in front, you know, so he did something a little different. Everybody said, look at that, he turns his back to the audience. It's different, so it's a performance.
It's an interesting initiative that we'll follow and see if we can fill that gap here too in that way.
That would be nice, yeah. You know?
A good example for us.
Well, you know, you had a great friend of mine, it's so sad that Tones Hermans was a wonderful performer, yeah. And he was a great friend of mine, and I was sorry that he died, you know. It feels different coming back here, because I've had so many beautiful days with him. He was a wonderful painter, yeah. Plus a great, great artiste.
Yeah. I want to go, I almost jumped to my third question because you mentioned Tone Hermans, but I'll just do my second first. You recently put out an Ellington CD,
yes.
Duke Ellington CD. With the among orchestra pieces, also with the same quartet, the Ralph Sharon quartet that you perform with here. Obviously, you will be doing some of that stuff tonight.
Oh yes, right? Definitely. Yeah.
You have worked with Duke Ellington. You were friends. You
yes.
painted him. How did that that situation, that friendship, that intimacy that you had with him play a role in the recording of this CD and in the performances that you do with the quartet?
Well, it's the most natural I feel, you know. I like my signature song is I Left My Heart in San Francisco. And everybody says, don't you ever get tired of singing that? Because I do it all over the world. I get commissioned to sing it. It's made me a world citizen. I happen to love the song. But one song I've sung many more times is a song called Don't Get Around Much Anymore by Duke Ellington. And I started when I was, working as a waiter, a singing waiter. I used to, when I first started at 17 years old, I was working tables in restaurants and taking requests and singing. And I would sing that song every single night, Don't Get Around Much Anymore. And all the musicians I've ever met of any worth, they all do Duke Ellington. More so than the Beatles. As much as the Beatles are advertised and promoted and everything, and everybody talks out of millions of records that they sold. But everywhere I go in the world, I hear Duke Ellington. If I go into a restaurant or a bistro or a hotel lobby where there's a piano player or a trio or, you know, live music anywhere, whether it's Belgium or Malaysia or New Zealand, wherever it is, I always hear someone playing Duke Ellington.
But it must be, in your case, it must be different for somebody because it's a very contemporary CD in its arrangements, in its whole treatment of the recording. It must be different for someone who has known him, who has worked with him to do it, than for somebody for who it is a tradition that is one step away from him.
Well, it was very inspiring. He changed my life in many ways, you know, personal situations that were very warm and beautiful. He was a great, great man, and he's really practically saved my life, because at one time I was really at the lowest ebb of my life. I had a very tragic situation going on, and it was Christmas Eve, and I was the loneliest I ever felt in the world, and he and Louis Belson, the great drummer, they sent a whole chorus up to my hotel room, and they all were singing On a Clear Day You Could See Forever. And that's the kind of man Duke was. He was a humanist and an optimist, and very positive. He's a fascinating man, you know. You know, the great indignity of blacks, the way they were treated so many times, they weren't allowed to go in certain hotels, white hotels. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he had an answer for everything. He would say, well, how does the president of the United States, this was in the 30s, 1930, he'd say, how does the president travel? He said, well, he travels in a train, and he has a caboose, and then his staff is in the other railroad cars. He said, well, let's do that. And he went in a train, so he didn't have to go through the indignity of being turned away from a hotel. And he'd go to a town and do a concert, get back on the train, and go to the next town. So he had a way of getting, he was very positive about things. He was very wonderful. I mean, a great philosopher, really.
don't get around much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A combination of brilliance and a form of simplicity.
Yes.
What does make a great melody? What is for you the definition of a great melody?
Well, when it hits you emotionally, you know, I had Ruby Braff, the great cornet player. He said it best of all. He said, a melody is God. You know, and it doesn't sound right if you don't have a melody. No matter, I mean, there are a lot of new avant-garde composers that are in the abstract, and that's all very interesting, and they do some phenomenal modes of music and everything, pretty good. But there's nothing like Louis Armstrong, you know. When you mentioned the word simplicity, he did everything simple, but it was better than anything that anybody ever did in jazz. To this day, anything that's ever been invented, which is whatever pop category today, whether it's grunge or hip-hop or, you know, rap, whatever it is, Louis invented all that. He invented everything. He was a genius. But he did it simple, like you mentioned. Duke was simple also, but very incongruous, very different. Even though it was melodic, didn't sound like anybody else's music. It sounded like Duke Ellington. He's a creative artist, genius.
The melody and the harmony is there, then you come in and you perform it, you bring it to the ears, you bring it to the emotions of the people. I want to go to my last subject about that. You did, I mentioned you made a beautiful painting of Ellington. There's also on the new CD a painting of Ellington by you. Mr. Bennett, the performing artist, Mr. Benedetto, the painter.
Right.
Both of those gentlemen work with color.
Yes.
Will it be a musical color or a visual color? Is there for you somewhere a link between those two identities with the word color? Because is there a link for you?
It's a very good question, because there's a lot of critics that say there is, that they're completely different. But I happen to think that there is a difference. There is a similarity, I'm sorry. There's a similarity. I mean, you have basic ingredients. For any of the crafts, whatever craft it is, you have line, form, color, value, balance, all of these rules, that it's the form. And that pertains to cooking or playing tennis or, you know, any craft or high-level art, whether it's oil painting or watercolor or singing or dancing. Whatever the creative arts are, any of the cultures, those are the basic rules. And they pertain to, I mean, Leonardo da Vinci is the tip-off to that you could do many things, you know, because if you realize that it's all these four or five elements that create this simplicity and make it all work, the composition, balance, you know, what to leave out, keep it simple. that's all that pertains to cooking. It pertains to every craft, every form of a creative process. It's a creative process. So I think it's all one thing.
If you have the combination of melody with certain harmonies and you are performing them, do you actually think of colors?
Absolutely. Yeah, nuance. See it's. This sounds like a critique. I think it is, actually. In rock and roll, you know, it starts loud, and the middle's loud, and it ends loud. You know, it's just loud, right from, there's no balance. You know, it's not like Count Basie, where it starts soft, and just as it just feels very nice, you know, all of a sudden, boom, a big blast of the chorus comes in, everybody jumps up, whoop, what happened, you know? And then soft again, it's nuance. You know, it's values, and they're all balanced. They're all balanced. They had at a certain correct timing, so that it's just the right time. So Count Basie used to just right in the middle of one. He never had a microphone on his piano, but he would just hit one note on the piano just at the right time. It was louder than the whole brass section, because it was just the right moment of silence. You know, just the band would hit a big blasting note, you know, and there would be this silence, and obviously, ding, ba-do-da-do-da-do, you know, and it just, right away, wow, what's that?
I want to close the circle of this brief conversation. We started with crooners. I would like to end with them. The art of intimate singing. You as a icon of a tradition, and somebody who is now also stepping into the in the teaching with your new initiative that you just mentioned. What is your prognosis for the art form as it is in the future?
It's going to last forever, because you know, improvisation has happened many, many years ago by great master composers, classical composers. I mean, they would play just a few bars and they would take an oboe or another English horn or whatever, and they would say, you know, just play whatever you feel here. And they would do it just for a bar or so. And it was invented in New Orleans, where they elongated the improvisation and they just kept playing right straight through, you know, maybe two or three choruses of the 32 bars that they were basing it on. Well, what happened was it invented the only thing in the United States that's really our tradition. We've made a lot of money, we've been very successful, but we, you know, what's our tradition? What are we leaving to the rest of the world? Like the Italians left music and art, and the French and the Dutch and the Holland and everything. They've great painters, yeah. You know, and the British theater. Art form is the entertainment world. We have a style. It's American. It's completely different because it's not one philosophy. It's many different philosophies. I happen to like it. It's a great palette, yeah, to work with. You know, every different nationality has contributed to it, and there's plenty to work with. And it's really a great art form. I just love it because you really meet individuals that are unbelievable. I mean, they're playing for the moment. It's not premeditated. It's not planned. They just see what the atmosphere is, the moment, and then, boom, it comes out. And they don't know what, it's just their life and everything they feel at the moment. And it's terribly exciting. I think it's one of the great forms of music that's ever been invented, because it just comes out of the spirit of the human being, the individual, or the group of individuals that are harmonizing together. But it happens, they do it spontaneously. It's not premeditated. And it's terribly exciting music. To me, it's the best entertaining music. It's alive. Every time I hear it, you just say yes. It's just like I just heard a quote by Ira Gershwin. He says, "I never knew my songs were that good until I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing them." You know, that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's that one concept of that individual that hears it a certain way, and it's just completely spontaneous. They just create right on the spot. It's wonderful.
Mr. Benedetto, grazie. Mr. Bennett, thank you.
Thank you, Cole.
Tot zover deel 4 van de Jazzism podcast. Je kunt reageren via info@jazzism.nl. info@jazzism.nl. En zeg er dan even bij dat het om deze podcast gaat. Dankjewel voor je tijd, Rafael Hermans. Check via het internet zijn prachtige kunstwerken. En wil je meer informatie, dan kun je ook dat e-mailadres dat ik net noemde gebruiken. In deel 5 ga ik denk ik eens praten met Michiel Borslap, want die is met een bijzonder Herbie Hancock project bezig. Daarover later meer. Voor nu bedankt voor het luisteren. Mijn naam is Code Kloet. Zeg ik alleen nog, gedag allemaal.